All right, this is the title of my talk, and let's get right into it. This is one of the significant conundrums of modern physics, namely dark matter and dark energy. And a couple of days ago, I counted the number of papers on dark matter. On the archive, it was six. So it's averaging five or six a day, multiplied by 360. Well, less taking off weekends. That's a lot of papers. So this shows the significance of this subject for modern physics. So today we have, according to the standard model of cosmology, we have this much dark energy and this much green dark matter. And this is what I consist of, not much, 4% me, and the rest of the visible universe. So 11.7 billion years ago, we had this. This is around the time of surface of last scattering. And dark matter, of course, was very dominant. And atoms, again, were not too significant. Okay. So, to me, I was looking at a lecture by Richard Feynman. Just happened to come across it on YouTube, I think. And he was giving a lecture on how you derive the fundamental laws of physics. And he wrote up on the blackboard, guess. So the audience laughed. And then you have theory. And then you have experimental data. And he said you have a guess, intuition. It depends on whether you're doing top-down physics or up-down physics, up, bottom-up. So you derive theories from experiment quite often. Some problem with experimental data that is not understood. Or else you start like Einstein with general relativity, intuition, guess, get a theory, get experimental data. And he said, this is the important part. He said, I don't care what the name of the person is who had the guess, how important the person is, whether the person has a Nobel Prize, we have to match with experimental data. Otherwise, you can throw it out and start over by guessing again. So this is going to be important for this talk. We all know that the dynamics of galaxies, as well as the whole universe, reveal that a main part of the universe's mass must be missing on modern cosmology. This is the missing dark matter. Originally proposed by the Swiss physicist, astronomer Zwicky, 1933-34, on the basis of observations of the Coma cluster in the constellation Coma Berenice. And it was dormant for, the problem was dormant more or less for 40 years. And then came along the work of Rubin and Rubin and Ford, 65, 70s, which showed that the speed of stars going around in galaxies is much faster than predicted by Newtonian gravity. So the dark matter issue became more significant, according to a paper by Peebles and Ostriker in Princeton. who said that there had to be a dark matter halo around galaxies. Okay, so we will now discover, I hope, I think I can show, that there are two situations we are confronted with. Einstein gravity does not work in order to fit all the available data presently, unless you do two things. One, introduce dark matter, 80-90% of the matter of the present universe. Two, modify gravity, modify Einstein gravity and Newtonian gravity. You can't fit the data unless you do that, as we'll see. Einstein gravity works remarkably well in the solar system, passed all the tests, and down to the decimal places, it's been checked. However, when you advance up in scale, distant scale to galaxies, spirals, clusters, galaxy clusters, the early universe cosmology, things start going wrong. Now, there's been a great effort to detect dark matter. We presume that if there is dark matter, then it consists of some dark matter particles. And so far, nobody has detected dark matter in a convincing way, either in underground experiments like LUX or at the LHC, supersymmetric particles or whatever, or in astrophysical observations. For example, the alpha magnetic spectrometer experiment, AMS, recent results, rather negative. White dwarfs recently, the latest. White dwarfs are supposed to be, not white dwarfs, dwarf galaxies. Dwarf galaxies are supposed to be the dominant dark matter object in the universe. And people look for dark matter annihilation, WIMP annihilation, and don't see it. In fact, the latest limit on a WIMP, weakly interacting massive particle, is 10 TeV. Okay, so what does this mean? We haven't detected dark matter. We may detect it. And however, if we do detect it, it has to be consistent with a lot of data, as I'll show. And this becomes important. So a particle you think that may be dark matter, if it doesn't fit astrophysics and astronomy and cosmological data, then it's no use as a candidate for dark matter. This is the latest LUX experiment. They're now increasing the xenon gas content. Xenon is an inert gas to 1 ton. And super LUX, and they're getting down to very low cross sections. The recoil from nuclear recoils of WIMPs is down to 10 to the minus 46 centimeters squared or below. And it's below that you begin to hit a noise. It's called a neutrino noise. And talking to the experts, it appears that when you hit that wall, that's the end of it, as far as this kind of experiment is concerned. The other candidate, of course, is a warmer dark matter called axions. And there are experiments underway to detect axions, which also supposedly solve the problem of the Peltier-Quinn strong interaction problem, which has been around in strong interactions for a long time. So it has a dual success if it's found. All right, now, I'm going to talk to you about modified gravity because I'm going to see how far I can get with the other alternative without dark matter in the present universe. And, well, To put it mildly, the situation is totally overwhelming. Because if you construct a modified gravity theory, you have to explain all of this. And if you don't explain it, if you fail miserably in one of these items, you're out. Like Feynman said, you go back and start over again. Okay. All right. We start with the Euler universe cosmology. You have to explain the data for the Planck WMAP CMB data. You have to explain structure growth, stars and galaxies. The universe has to expand at the proper rate, according to your. I use the standard model, Friedman-Lemaître Robertson-Walker model. You have to fit the angular acoustical power spectrum from Planck 2013. You have to fit the matter power spectrum. And you have to explain the accelerated expansion of the universe. Okay. Galaxy rotation curves and galaxy evolution and stability. That has to be explained. Galactic cluster dynamics, you have to get that right. Bulldog cluster, an Abel 520 cluster, the so-called train wreck collision. That has to work. Gravitational lensing in modern cosmology, got to get that right. Binary pulsar timing, which we heard about at the EHT 2014 meeting. And the gravitational radiation, that has to be worked out correctly. And finally, of course, solar system experiments. You have to explain all the accurate solar system experiments available. Weak equivalence principle, light deflection by the sun, Shapiro time delay, Cassini probe, planetary orbits. All right. In 1950-1916, when Einstein published his general relativity, it was much easier for him, as far as this is concerned. It was a brilliant idea, one of the most brilliant proposals in the history of science, namely that matter deforms space-time. It's the geometry of space-time that's important in non-Euclidean. However, as far as fitting the data was concerned, he had his three classical tests. Perihelion advance of Mercury, redshift spectral lines from white dwarfs, the sun, and the bending of light. And that was it. And he already had perihelion advance of Mercury in his pocket, 1915. So he knew he was on the right track. He always worried about experimental data when he constructed his theories, even though his theories started from a guess and from theory, from intuition. He worried about the data. Unfortunately, in modern physics today, I have to say that I'm concerned about the lack of often interest or necessity for this in modern physics. And this is very bad, in my opinion. Okay. All right, so I've been working on modified gravity theories for a long time. I won't go on about how long it was, but anyway, it's a long time. And trying to modify Einstein gravity is extremely difficult because the theory is very elegant, beautiful, and it's very tight. So if you start trying to modify one little piece, you soon get into some trouble, either from a theoretical physics point of view or from the point of view of experimental data. It's like taking a hammer and a chisel to David's statue in Florence, okay? you're beginning to mutilate something beautiful, and you have to pay the consequences. So unless you can convincingly show that your modified gravity really has to work, and the GR cannot, or Newtonian gravity cannot fit the data, then you should be careful by abandoning this theory. Okay.
John, just a question. This may just be terminology, but this maybe I'm missing something. This actually looks to me like if I do a conformal scaling of a metric, I can consider this just Einstein gravity with a particular set of matter content. I can consider this as Einstein gravity with a particular matter content. Is that right or wrong?
Wrong.
Okay,
you're going to tell us why? I will explain. In order to, so this is a paper I published in 2006 at JCAP, and the talk will be based largely on this. And what do you have to do if you want to avoid using dark matter in the present universe? Then you have to introduce extra degrees of freedom. Gravitational degrees of freedom. And for me, the extra degrees of freedom were this vector field with a mass and varying big G, Newtonian gravitational constant, as one does in Jordan-Bransticki theory. Those are the two main degrees of freedom. Additionally to that, the mass of this vector field described by the parameter mu was taken to be a scalar field function of x. Okay, this is the electric field, and these are the field equations, and so on. So the action for pressureless dust can be written this way. Here, rho is the density of matter, Q5 is the fifth force, the additional vector field force. Source charge, which is related to the mass. So I have Q5 equal to kappa rho, where kappa is a constant. So kappa turns out to be this constant. Alpha is dimensionless. So the vector field is truly gravitational. It's proportional to the square root of g. By the way, the square root of g times m has dimensions of electric charge. So Q is like an electric charge. I choose a positive root for this. So Q is always positive. It's always a repulsive force. So you vary the fields and you get this energy momentum tensor. These are the field energies and matter sources. So the variation of the matter source, the matter action, gives you this matter current, J mu, for the vector field. And this is the action for a test particle. And Q5 is again proportional to the test particle mass. And this is the equation of motion for the test particle with mass. And P mu alpha, this is like a Lorentz force on the right-hand side. So the mass is cancelled. So the equation of motion for a test particle with mass satisfies the weak equivalence principle. All right, so you work out the modified weak field Newtonian acceleration law. This is what you get. Alpha is dimensionless parameter. This is the potential associated with this. So you can see that when r goes to zero, the radius from a point source located at r equal to zero, when r goes to zero, this goes to 1, and this goes out, and you get alpha minus alpha, which is 0. You get back Newtonian gravity. So there's a screening mechanism built into the theory obtained from the field equations and the action for test particles. This is the Poisson equation for extended distribution of matter. The photon follows a null geodesic. And for this, I invoke a screening mechanism in dense environments due to the nonlinearity of the interaction potentials and their coupling strength. There's a lot of large literature on this at the moment.
So what happens to massless particles?
For massless particles, the Feynman field does not screen. It's not present.
It doesn't couple the massless particles?
No. Okay. Or very, it's very weakly coupled, so it doesn't help when you have a photon moving very close to the sun, for example.
But I mean, it's puzzling because the mass drops out of the equation, the equivalent of the geodesic equation, so...
Yeah, but still, when you work it out, you have to... I'll show you why this is true in a minute. So we can rewrite the action for the big G scalar field this way. Just a normal, minimally coupled action for scalar field. And so I do a conformal transformation on the metric G mu nu. And in the Jordan frame, it looks like this. These are the field equations. I follow the route of papers on screening mechanisms in the literature. And in the Einstein frame, I get an effective gravitational coupling, which depends, scalar field depends on the density, the environment. And
because I don't think you mean what?
Well, G is not G Newton here. Okay. G is, can be much bigger than G Newton. So this is the problem.
So by answering, do you mean going to a conformal transformation where you absorb what you call G and replace that by just a constant, or do you mean something else?
Yeah, G squiggle is approximately constant, but it's not the Newtonian constant. It's screened. Okay. The problem is that, okay. As we will see, the enhancement of G means I get stronger gravity, which means I can fit galaxy rotation curves and cluster virial theorem because gravity is stronger. Not because of dark matter making it stronger, but because G is stronger. However, when you go to the solar system, you have to screen that G in order to get the right deflection of light for the sun or Cassini. Well, in the Brandsticky, normal Brandsticky, you assume that in the Einstein frame, G is just G Newton. I don't do that. So I don't do that. G is not G Newton in the Einstein frame. Okay. So this is the potential for this extended distribution of matter. So now you can show, I have a paper on this in the archive, you can show that there are two types of screening going on, a repulsive gravitational Yukawa force, which screens the massive test particles. And then this is the vector field. And then the scalar field is screened in the vicinity of the sun and earth, guaranteeing solar system experiments. This is all explained in this paper. So this is a picture taken by the son of my collaborator, Sohrab Rava, fractional second picture of an apple falling. So this is what's happening. For test particle mass, you have a Yukawa repulsive force, gravitational force, and you have an enhanced Newtonian force, and they balance one another as you go into the solar system or the binary pulsar, for example. Now, if you go and give a talk at a conference and you say, I can fit 100 galaxies without dark matter, someone's going to put up their hand and say, well, what about cosmology? Well, I haven't got around to that yet. Okay. This is no use. I've been to talk conferences where people do this. So, cosmology. So I'm going to start from the beginning and work my way up towards the solar system, through surface of large scattering, recombination, and formation of stars and galaxies, and up to the present day. You have to fit this data. All right, so I take as a background the usual FLR RW metric. And this is my energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid. And rho is a sum of these different energy contents from my action, modified gravitational action. So these are the Friedmann equations I get. lambda, I adopt lambda as a cosmological constant. Shamelessly, in spite of the severe fine-tuning problems associated with it, namely the vacuum density, vacuum energy problem, hierarchy problem, which I think can be solved, by the way. I can say it right now. I think lambda is probably the correct solution to dark energy. And the cosmological constant problem is a quantum gravity problem. It doesn't exist unless you turn on the gravitational field. In Minkowski space-time, there is no cosmological constant problem. And then if you turn on the gravitational field, you have gravitons coupled to the vacuum, and you have to have a way of dynamically suppressing the enormous discrepancy with the experiment, namely the bounds on vacuum density and vacuum energy. That's the subject of another talk. All right, so now I assume a flat universe, k equal to zero, g, I assume that g dot is approximately constant for the cosmology, and so is the mu dot, the mass of the, actually the mass will evolve in the cosmology. And this is the field equations I get. And they look like Einstein's, the standard model, except because rho has all the matter contents, which I have, and g is varying. And you do Fourier transforms to pick up density profile, relative density profile. This is the Poisson equation. Once you've assumed an FLRWGR background, you start doing Newtonian gravity to do the perturbations. So as mentioned, this is the modified gravity acceleration formula, non-relativistic for a massive test particle, point particle. And the potential is given here for the extended distribution, which we have to deal with in cosmology. Can't use a point particle solution. And this is the Boltzmann equations. And these are the capital omegas, the matter content of the universe. Okay, in the present scenario, there are five components to the energy density. There's a neutral pressureless fion particle, the phi mu and phi mu field. Phi mu field looks like a photon, but it has a mass. It's often referred to as a hidden photon in the present literature. People are looking for hidden photons. I think people are looking for it here, actually. So, these are the different components of density. Now I'm going to assume that rho phi dominates in the early universe before decoupling around time of recombination. At the time of horizon entry, from horizon entry to the formation of stars and galaxies, phi is going to dominate. The hidden massive photon will dominate. It's electrically neutral, so it doesn't couple to photons, so it's collisionless effectively. It looks like cold dark matter in the early universe. Alpha is going to be less than 1, so g is approximately g Newton. So this guarantees that you get the right answer for Big Bang nuclear synthesis, which is one of the best calculations in modern cosmology, and you have to agree with that. So when you start forming stellar and galaxy formation, rho phi is going to be much less than baryon density, and the Mach non-relativistic acceleration law sets in to explain the rotation curves of galaxies and the dynamics of clusters without detectable dark matter and everything else in the present universe. Now I'm going to explain why I think this is true. It's coming. Okay, so we before at horizon entry, we have this.
I didn't understand how rho phi dominates, but at the same time, we have g at the same. G is the same as g newton. So if rho phi dominates, then even it's there's more than more rho phi is bigger than rho radiation. Is that what you're?
Rho phi dominates because of the following reason. If you try to construct a theory with just protons, baryons, you fail because you can't do cosmology with it. Okay, it doesn't work. Believe me, I've tried.
So rho phi is your dark matter.
That's right.
Okay, that is why any universe rho phi is
called dark matter. I'm getting there. I take the potential to be zero. And this is the Friedmann equation. Rho phi is dominant. And now you have the Jeans equation for density perturbations, a well-known equation. This is the speed of sound. And we have two parts, pressure due to proton, photon interaction. And just the gravitational interaction for for collisionless particles. Okay, so you work this out. Phi mu is this Brocker field. It's mass of spin one particle and mass of spin photon, and so forth. So the speed of sound is zero. It's collisionless, and you get this equation, the Jeans equation, with just the gravitational contribution. So that there's no.
Sorry, I don't understand the second. Pressure in your compass does not mean the thing that enters in the Einstein equations on the right hand side.
Yeah, but there's no pressure if you have collisionless particles.
Yeah. Not in the Einsteinian sense.
The speed of sound is zero. The speed of sound is the square root of the pressure over the density.
It's not collisionless.
Speed of sound is zero.
If they are cold, then there is no pressure.
That's correct. Yeah. So. However, there is oscillatory behavior of the fine particles and perturbations grow at all wavelengths. On the other hand, the baryon perturbation oscillates before decoupling due to the photon baryon pressure producing baryon acoustical oscillations. After decoupling, the density perturbations grow, as I'll show you, and catch up with the fine delta rho, be it the baryon density perturbations. The fine density perturbations solve the problem of getting sufficient growth to form stars and galaxies later in the universe. This is an essential thing that you have to get in early universe cosmology. And this is the only way I know to do it, unless there's some completely different way of doing cosmology.
With the sound speed better, the sound speed in the Jeans equation isn't the uniform pressure, it's the pressure perturbation, delta P over delta rho. Are you just setting that to zero by hand, or are you actually solving the equations of motion for phi and self-consistently finding delta P to be zero? Because delta P should scale with 1 over the square root of the mass.
Well, actually,
you're playing off
The delta rho, the perturbations, delta rho, go logarithmically. You can show this.
Delta P for the phi.
The sound speed is small. I'm assuming it's small.
You're assuming it's small. You're not actually solving the equation of motion for phi.
No, it's small. I go the standard route.
That would be something that, you know, one should check.
This is a simple explanation. Things can get much more complicated by solving the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah.
And there is pressure, there's a small amount of pressure. You have to do all of this in a code, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, this is what you get. Okay, this is what we have. So this is horizon entry. This is delta rho over rho. Rho I, the initial density. Squared, this is the cosmic scale. So here we have this logarithmic growth, which is enough growth to get you up here and produce structure growth for stars and galaxy formation. And this is the protons doing their job. They produce oscillations. up to after the surface of light scattering when photons start streaming freely. Okay, so so when you go beyond the time of recombination decoupling, G now becomes significant. It's equal to G Newton times 1 plus alpha. Eventually, as the large scale structures form, this you have this, and the band dominated mark takes over. The Gaussian rotation curves and the galactic cluster dynamics are determined without dark matter. So I'll show you what happens, the best fit to galaxies and clusters I obtained in this paper published in MNRES with Sora Rava. And this is the value of the mass parameter. So the mass of the fion, this hidden photon, evolves and it becomes ultra light in the present universe. And the reason is that in order to fit all the present galaxy, cluster galaxy data and whatever, the mass of the fion field becomes large, and this is what it is. M phi 2.6 times 10 to minus 28 electron volts is this value. So in order to fit all the data, you're forced into a photon called dark matter particle in the present universe, which is ultra light and probably can't be detected.
So this is not the very
they're cold. Linked. You're linking the mass of the particle.
So this is
to
not
the
a
data.
Very cold dark matter, right? Because the mass is
it's ultra light, it's not cold. It's it's so warm that it's not gonna form halos, okay.
So mass of 10 to the -28 is it's not gonna form halos.
This scenario is the opposite to the axiom scenario, where the axiom freezes in and you can use a smaller value of the axiom mass to fit, supposedly fit, galaxies and all that data. Maybe. And this is, runs the opposite way.
Are you going to tell us how the mass changes with time?
Not in this talk, but this is a more evolved thing to get into. I don't have time.
It
works, okay. But the one explanation is that the mass goes through a phase transition. And this allows you to go from a somewhat cold dark matter value of maybe M phi of order 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 6 electron volts up to this ultralight value. Okay, so I conclude from this that the dark matter particle cannot be detected in the present universe, in my theory, either by laboratory experiments or astrophysical observations. I should never say cannot, because in physics you have to be careful of saying something cannot be observed, but this is so light that it's unlikely. All right, now we get down to the nitty-gritty. I have to calculate the CMB in my MOG. So this is the power spectrum, delta squared. This is the so-called transfer function. And in the CMB before the last surface of last guiding, as we remember, phi dominates. So this we get the standard kind of lambda CDM picture. And in the present universe, the density of rho phi is much less than rho baryon, but G is bigger. So when you look at it, you find that if alpha is of order 6 or 7, 8, then this Gn times rho, which is what you measure in lambda, is equal to my MOG result because of the alpha. And in particular, you get this here and here. And rho MOG is rho, but it's just a baryon for protons. So if you redshift towards a CMB using CMB fast, the code, you find that you smoothly get rho phi bigger than rho baryon as you approach the CMB, and you get this result. So it follows that the angular power spectrum calculation can be duplicated in MOG using the Planck 2013 best fit values. There are six parameters that do this. These are the six parameters. There are extra parameters, but these are the six important parameters. And by the way, 2013 data, they have, they're using five figures. This is amazing, okay? They're using five figures, four figures, to determination of these parameters. This is quite frightening, actually. And if you think you can avoid this, don't try, okay? Yeah.
One of those parameters is that they can be assuming a flat universe. So if you give it,
this is all for flat universe.
Yeah, so omega lambdas are redundant parameters. If you give H, then omega lambda is fixed.
You've assumed a flat universe.
Yeah.
And it's model dependent. You have six parameters.
Right, but the they're not the six parameters. The six parameter is tau.
There's another parameter, yeah. I haven't included all of them.
There are at least eight
parameters in total. But these are the six dominant parameters.
No, I think the idea was saying there is one more that you're missing here.
Yeah.
The optical depth.
And there is aren't all.
There's the optical depth, but I haven't included that. I think these are the six important ones. If you don't get them right, you're certainly not going to fit the data. Okay, so the value of alpha today is this value. If you add that to one, you get 5.3367, and that gives you value of big G. Okay, so this is it. That's what you need. If you don't fit this, you're out. To me, this is one of the most extraordinary results in modern cosmology. We're talking about 1% fit. Now, we get to the matter power spectrum. The matter power spectrum consists of the following. You do a statistical analysis. You determine the correlations for the distance between different for galaxies, nearby galaxies. And you get a correlation function, you Fourier transform it, use a transfer function, and you can calculate the power spectrum. And if you do this with Einstein gravity and Newtonian gravity, without dark matter, the result comes out very bad. This dotted lines here are Einstein Newtonian gravity with out dark matter. And there's no way that's ever going to fit the data here. This curve here is lambda CDM dotted curve. So that's it. You either modify gravity or you have dark matter. Einstein Newtonian gravity cannot fit the data, period. So when you do a modified gravity, you have to put in a window function from MIT. You use the SDSS data to do the analysis, to calculate the spectrum. And what you find is that in the transfer function up there, this is missing in the present universe. So you're looking at galaxies with halos or not halos, all the way back to the beginning of the universe where galaxies were first formed, some millions of years after the Big Bang, all the way back. That's what determines the matter power spectrum. And so what you get if you put in the window function is this. This red is the prediction from MOG, my modified gravity. The chi-square for that fit to the data is as good as lambda CDM. So, so this is a generic test of dark matter and modified gravity.
It seems that you're mixing and matching different things. I mean, it seems that for the CMU, you said this is just all dark matter. Your fire is just like all dark matter.
So then everything should just be just like cold dark matter because, I mean, you don't have a window. I mean, all the predictions will be identical. You don't even have to have a different curve.
No, but in the matter power spectrum, below 0.1, you're getting into early universe. And you're following the halo of galaxies all the way back. until you when you do the power spectrum, you have to put in an initial value for the power spectrum, P naught, by hand. It's assumed to be scaling variant, and so it's just put in by hand. But the data comes from galaxy surveys all the way back, LRGs all the way back to some million years after the Big Bang. So if they don't have dark matter halos, then...
Yeah, but none of that enters in this prediction, because those are what happens inside the galaxies. This prediction, the shape of this blue curve is all set at redshift of 1,000 or about 100 to 1,000, basically.
The blue curve is lambda CM prediction.
But I'm saying you have, your model is identical to lambda CVM down to...
No, not in the present universe.
Not in the present universe.
No.
But I'm saying this
curve
is...
Well, the present means going back to the beginning of galaxy formation.
I think what happens here is that everything's the same for the CMB because the phi particle is very heavy there.
That's right.
But then in the late universe where you observe this, it becomes lighter. So
I think this shape is set up in the early universe, not in the late universe, because...
No, but early universe
is... If you then made, rho c time-dependent, which is essentially what happens when the phi particle becomes massless, you then subtract that out, so you keep TB at the right amplitude, but you take TC out of it. I think that's the idea.
Just to clarify, when does this transition for the ion mass change, when does
it
that take
starts
place?
Transition, it starts when you begin to form the first stars, the first galaxies.
But so then that only affects a structure of a small halos. Doesn't affect the larger scalar structure. Larger scalar structure is set at the time of decoupling.
Sometime after decoupling.
So I'm saying that this
shape... You're looking at galaxies. Okay, you're doing correlation functions for the distance between galaxies.
Right.
So
and
if you don't have galaxies, you don't have any data. Okay?
Right. So that is frozen at the time of, not at decoupling exactly, but a few Hubble times after the decoupling, that is frozen, right? So my point is, I think here you're mixing and matching two different things. Your new model, phion, is the same as dark matter, at least at early times. I guess you had an old model in which phion was not the same as dark matter, but much lighter. So, and I think this is a prediction for your old model where phion was light.
It's more or less, we're putting out a paper, my collaborator Victor Toth and I, and redoing this, by the way. But it's going to be more or less the same story, actually.
I think it seems that the most non-trivial thing in your newest story is that phase transition when you go from cold dark matter to, I guess, hot dark matter or something else, or axion.
Right.
So that's the thing that's missing in the story. That what that does that damage anything?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Anyway, so what happens is that the following. This is the latest data. This is in a paper by Batty, Charnock, and Moss, which is appearing in MNRES. And they claim this result for this data here is 5 sigma. So there's a 5 sigma discrepancy for lambda CDM in the matter power spectrum. I consider this a very important result. There's a lot of explanation in the paper about how you can avoid this tension between CMB and the matter power spectrum. Anyway, for Mark, you come along here. We've rather exaggerated the unit oscillations, but this is an exaggerated picture of what can happen. We can fit right back to the beginning of the early galaxies. Unit oscillations have already appeared because this is a generic test of modified gravity versus dark matter. If the unit oscillations continue to appear, you cannot get this from a dark matter model, because in dark matter, the dark matter particles in the galaxy halos, which is what you're looking at, are collisionless. So there's no pressure. If there's no pressure, there's no dissipation. And you can't get these unit oscillations. All you get is that smooth curve, lambda CDM. On the other hand, if you don't see the unit oscillations eventually, then modified gravity is wrong, because you're fitting the galaxy halos with baryons, and if the baryons are have huge pressure. I mean, so you get acoustical oscillations. And if you don't see them in the matter per spectrum, modified gravity is dead. Doesn't matter which modified gravity you have.
When your new modified gravity is not dead because it's just like all dark matter.
No. The new modified gravity is correct because the galaxies that you're surveying have no dark matter halo at present, going back to 1 million years after the Big Bang. Okay, I have to move on. Fitting the supernova data, yes, we can do that. The blue curve is lambda CDM, and the mark is sitting inside the blue curve. No problem. Okay, rotation curves. So what we do is we take the modified Newtonian acceleration law I showed you earlier, and with SORAB, RAVA, we put in models for the disk, the bulge, and do a proper job. You have to put them in. By the way, there's a myth that the galaxy rotation curves are flat. That's not always true. It's actually not correct. They're sometimes flat, they're sometimes not flat. And you have to fit all of this. So what we do is we take the data from the things catalog, and we fix alpha mu. There are only two parameters, alpha and mu. And I showed you what they are. And this is what's observed, this is what's predicted. This is a typical picture. Data, Newtonian, Keplerian prediction. This is the things catalog. It's the best accurate catalog for rotation curves. And this is what it means, things. Okay, so we fix alpha and mu using these galaxies, and we do a best fits, and we get this result that the alpha is 8.89 plus or minus 0.34, and mu is given by this. That's it. Now, we then have universal alpha and mu, and I go and fit 100 galaxies, okay, with no free parameters. All I have to put in is the mass to light ratio of each galaxy. In the case of cold dark matter in the present universe, dark matter halos, you need at least 6 parameters per galaxy because you've got to put in the bulge in the disk. You can't use a point particle solution for a halo. So if you do 100 galaxies, you have 100 times 6, 600 free parameters. I claim cold dark matter models will never do as good as this. Okay. If you want to use Occam's razor, you're welcome. This is the simplest explanation for rotation curves of galaxies, my modified gravity explanation, as far as the freedom of parameters is concerned. So this is what we get. The chi-square overall for what I'm showing is about 1. Excellent fits. And there are no free parameters. These are large-scale spiral galaxies, low surface brightness galaxies, dwarf galaxies. We've done all of it. Okay. Now, there's new data for the velocity dispersion and rotation curves of our galaxy, the Milky Way. And this is the latest data published in the AppJ. It goes out to 200 kiloparsecs, which is way outside the so-called edge of these galaxies, the spiral galaxy, our galaxy. And again, you put in the alpha mu, which is known. And this red, this curve here, is the there is the fit obtained from the parameters that Sohrab and I determined. It's quite remarkable. Think about what I've done. I've taken the solution for all the other galaxies, alpha mu, plus plug it in and predict what I get. And there's an excellent fit. And the dotted line is MOND, Milgram's Modifying Newtonian Dynamics. It doesn't work. And the reason is it's flat. So if you put in a beta with a R-squared dependence, then you can maybe fiddle it to get some fit. It's not very good. This is the dark matter fit. According to the best formulas we've used, this is the dashed line here. It requires fitting the data with somewhat large anisotropy. I don't think there is any isotropy measurable way out there, but that's the result. Okay, color, you can determine the master light ratios from our results. And in particular, the theory immediately predicts the Tully-Fisher law, namely that the velocity to the fourth power is proportional to the mass. This is not true for Newtonian gravity. It comes right out. It's a beautiful fit to the data. So now the globular clusters. Tully-Fisher is predicted. It comes right out of the formula. This is not true for dark matter. You have to put it in by hand. This is a well-known problem for dark matter.
What means do you predict
Milgram's MOND is designed to do it, of course. And dark matter models, you have to put it in by hand. This has always been a controversial issue. But it's trivial to show it comes out of my modified Newtonian acceleration formula. Okay, globular clusters, we've done that, published AppJ. Gene's equation, you haven't triggered MOG yet because the mass of the cluster is, globular cluster is not big enough, so you get Newtonian behavior. Very nice fits.
Maybe you could say more about why is it trivial to see that it comes out of your modified acceleration formula?
The Gene's equation when you solve it for the globular clusters. The mass, the size of the mass of the object has to reach a certain threshold before you begin to see the exponential in my modified acceleration law. And you don't do that for the globular cluster masses around 10 to the 8 solar masses. You have to get above that.
Sorry, I'm asking about Tully-Fisher.
Oh, Tully-Fisher, yeah.
How is it easy to see that it comes out of there?
Well, I have to talk to you later about that. I'm running out of time. It's easy, I'll show you. It's in my paper on MNRS with Sohrab Rao. Okay, clusters, I'll run through this quickly. You have to fit them. By the way, the fit of the big clusters with dark matter is not all that good, lambda CDM. So we go through here you have to fit the dynamical mass to the Newtonian mass. We have to use the same values of alpha and mu, no free parameters. And we find the best fit, chi-square fit, is for this. Beta has to be a 1. These have to be equal, this ratio. This is the value, the best fit value, 1 sigma level confidence. So it's remarkable. There are no free parameters. We just produce, give you the mass of the cluster and you do the fit. So these are the result for the dynamical mass versus this thing. The baryon mass versus dynamical mass with this parameter being close to 1. That's what we get. These are isothermal mass profiles. For clusters, they have to be fitted. MOND does not fit this without dark matter, Milgram's MOND. Milgram's MOND needs 60% of dark matter to fit the clusters. So I'll just run through this quickly. Okay, we get to the bullet cluster. The bullet cluster is the poster boy for dark matter. You go to talks, they say, bullet cluster shows beyond doubt that dark matter exists. Not true. I apply my mark to this, and what we have here is colliding clusters. This is the Chandra X-ray plasma observation. This is the blue corresponding to a galaxy lensing, the so-called Kappa convergence map in gravitational lensing. And so the mark has to do this without dark matter, just with protons. And these are the formulas, standard formulas, except that G has this contribution here. This is alpha. That's the fit. This is the data. This is the fit shown. This is in our paper, a paper with Joel Brownstein, a former graduate student, in MNRES 2007. It's a long paper, but I'm redoing this calculation right now. I'm redoing it to make sure that everything is correct. I'm working with a graduate student in the States doing this at present. I want to redo this. Now we have the ABLE520. This was originally a threat to dark matter because these authors claimed that there was a dark matter, large dark matter core inside the hot plasma, which you can't have. Dark matter particles are collisionless, so when they go through, they go to the sides. So do the galaxies. And all you're left with is the plasma, which is kept together by something called Ram pressure.
Can I ask about the previous one, about the bullet cluster? So to produce that convergence map on the right, that's predicted from what? What do you start from to get the?
I start from my modified acceleration law for an extended distribution. You can't use a point particle solution. Well, you calculate the surface density sigma. And then from the surface density sigma, you get what's called the Kappa map, convergence map, which tells you what the lensing is. It's a standard procedure.
So you take the X-ray data, tells you some distribution of gas.
Right. And then from equations, you predict the temperature. And we predict the temperature almost dead on. In the paper.
There's some rather kind of spherical distribution of the electrons in the middle. I mean, they somehow predict as the lensing.
The radiation produces this hot gas. It's the hottest, one of the hottest objects in the universe is the Chandra X-ray plasma.
I guess what I'm asking is, So the electrons don't, the idea is supposed to be that they don't show this barbell shape, whereas the dark matter does.
The dark matter is gone from the center.
Right. So but somehow you're saying this, that modified gravity takes a kind of a nearly spherical lump of electrons and predicts this convergence map with two Wilcox centers?
It's to do with the size of G. G offsets the matter in such a way that you get enough lensing on the sides. G is bigger. Every time I do something with out dark matter, I mimic it. I have a Xerox machine. So I put my dark matter thing in without dark matter, turn the crank with big G alpha, and out comes this result. Okay. Modify gravity. What you need is the gravitational strength is bigger to fit all the data. And that comes through big G and mu. Whereas from dark matter, it comes through shoveling in more matter on the right-hand side of Einstein's equation. It's really that simple. Okay. So I'm working on this at present to fit this data.
So I guess from the
from the X-rays, you get some projected density of the
baryons.
Of the baryons. To turn that into a three-dimensional density, you need to turn that into a three-dimensional density before you calculate your lensing, right?
No, you turn it into a two-dimensional surface density. You calculate the sigma, the surface density.
So in your theory, you only need the two-dimensional surface density.
You only need to determine sigma, the surface density. From that, you divide by what's called sigma critical, and you get the Kappa map. There's a report published on this, on gravitational lensing. I can give you the reference.
And you're saying the fact that the red has kind of two blobs is what leads to the predicted blue having two blobs.
That's right. So you have to predict the offset of gravitational lensing from your formula, and we've done that. So I'm working on this now, because I hadn't gotten around to doing this yet. And I'm doing this with this graduate student in the States. His name is Norman St. Michael Israel. I should mention, by the way, that all of this was done mainly by myself and with two or three collaborators since 2007. It's a lot of work. Victor Toth is one of my main collaborators in Ottawa. Joel Brownstein was a former graduate student. He's now on faculty at Utah University. He's doing large-scale galaxy surveys. And Sohrab Bravo, of course, is an important collaborator. He's at the University, Sharif University in Tehran. Okay, so... However, the ABLE 520, Chloe Dow, who originally did the bullet cluster, claimed that there is no dark core in ABLE 520. So they've revised the data and claimed there's no contradiction with dark matter. They published that in APJ the same year as the other people, Madhavi et al., published the supposed problem with dark matter. This is still somewhat controversial. Okay. Conclusions. So if experiments continue not to discover dark matter particles, underground experiments, the LHC, astrophysical observations, then we should begin to worry that the existence of dark matter can only be inferred from gravity in the present universe. I stress the present universe. The hidden mass of photon found by expressionless and massive enough to call dark matter before decoupling and recombination, allowing for structure growth. And the CMB acoustical power spectrum obtained from Mark agrees with Planck 2013. The Mark prediction is a dark matter fine particle hidden weakly interacting mass of photon that acts as cold dark matter up to formation of galaxy becomes altered light in the present universe. And undetectable, this can explain the failure to observe dark matter particles. Now, the reason I think this is a serious result is because I have linked the mass of this particle, the mu parameter, to all the fits of the galaxies, the bullet cluster, the clusters, with no arbitrary parameters, no free parameters. Anyone who wants to claim that they have a candidate for dark matter observed has to fit all the data I've shown you. They have to link the mass of the particle, whatever it is, to all this data and fit it. It's not a trivial matter, by the way. Thank you.
Can I ask another question about the bullet cluster? What if the electrons in the bullet cluster somehow the striking thing about the bullet cluster is that the electrons are close in and the convergence is located further out, peaks further out.
It's done by Ram pressure. It's called Ram pressure in astrophysics. It's the pressure caused by the proton, electron, photon. That's what's producing the heat.
Yeah, so I'm just asking about the lensing. So
the lensing, okay.
The electrons are close to the center. the convergence.
The protons and electrons. Yeah.
Protons and electrons are close to the center. The convergence is happening further out. And you say the modified gravity predicts that.
Yeah.
Now, if the electrons had, instead of being, you know, you can see in the electrons there's two lumps. What if it had just been one lump? What if it had just, for simplicity, been a spherically symmetric lump located in the middle? Would modified gravity still predict that the convergence was located further out than that lump?
Yeah, because you have to, the lensing.
So in other words, is your prediction for a normal galaxy? Let's forget about the Bullitt cluster.
Okay.
Consider just a more static cluster, a regular cluster, a spherically symmetric cluster.
Yeah.
Are you saying that you predict that the convergence peaks outside the far outside the cluster?
If I do the gravitational lensing for the clusters, which I've done, okay, and also for there's a list of lensing data, it fits because again. The cluster, of course, is the galaxies are moving randomly. It's not like a spiral galaxy where they're moving in circular orbits. So you have to deal with this from the equations. It works. I mean, if you read the papers, MNR, it's all in there.
I see. So you mean even for a spherical cluster, if you map the convergence, you see this fact that it's peaked outside the... when people observe a spherical cluster, they see...
You have weak lensing and strong lensing. And the weak lensing is when the light comes in near the cluster. Strong lensing is when it's going right through
the
center. And the weak lensing data is better, of course, more accurate. And it fits, again, because gravity is stronger.
This fact that you said, that there's weak lensing data far from the cluster and... stronger lensing as you get closer to the center of the cluster.
Yeah.
Isn't that saying the lensing is getting stronger and stronger as you go to the center of the cluster?
Well, stronger and stronger, it depends on either how much dark matter you have where you're looking, or how strong G is where you're looking. I mean, it's all to do with the data.
I guess I'm saying when people actually map the convergence for these clusters, do they find that it, as far as they can tell, it's monotonically increasing as you go to the center of the cluster? I think that's what people see,
yeah.
Right? So but you're saying your theory doesn't predict that. You're saying the Bullitt cluster is an example where your theory predicts convergence is weak at the center and then it gets stronger and then gets weaker.
Yeah, but the Bullitt cluster is two colliding clusters.
Right.
It's not the same as looking at a cluster sitting there, a very, very early stable cluster. It's a different problem. There's a main cluster peak.
Can we look at the picture?
Let me go back again. You see, you have to explain this offset of these two. This is called the subcluster. This is the shock wave. It's why it's called a bullet. It's like a bullet coming through. There's the bullet. It's a shock wave coming through. This is the main cluster, and this is the bullet, and this is the kappa lensing here on the sides. By the way, they assumed that the galaxy content here was assumed to be 5% or less. So we put in more galaxies, which we don't know how many galaxies are sitting there. And we put in 17% to check this. And that can add, of course, galaxies contain protons, and protons produce a bigger G. So if you have more galaxies in here, it produces a bigger lensing. So you have to fit the data to this. I forgot to mention, this is an important thing in my opinion. The generic test that distinguishes dark matter paradigm in the current universal log can be obtained from future large-scale galaxy surveys and the matter power spectrum. I consider this very important. The matter power spectrum is the key to the whole thing. Because if you don't see the oscillations, unit oscillations, modified gravity is dead. If you do see them, and there's some indication they're there in the new data for the matter power spectrum, coming in this paper by Batty, Chanock, and Moss coming out in Imanarius, then this is the test. It's a test on the data and the theory. And otherwise, I get tired of reproducing matter, dark matter results. Yeah, so I can get the same answer, maybe a lot less parameters, but I haven't proved that I'm right with the modified gravity. You can't disprove dark matter. So this is a generic test, I think. By the way, I forgot to mention that I'm doing them at the MOG black holes at present. I have a paper I've written where I have what's called the MOG black hole, because I have the vector field proportional to mass, so I get a Reisner-Nostrand type solution, but it's not electric charge, it's the gravitational mass charge due to the vector field. And I've also managed through this to construct a traversable wormhole. And it's based on a model by Eckelberg and Schein, published in Physical Review Letters in 1996. And I find this very interesting. Do I believe it? Not necessarily, but I haven't been able to get rid of it because it produces a time machine, and I'm not too happy about that. Anyway, this is something I'm doing at present.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.